Good afternoon and welcome. This is Central Coast Voices, and I'm your host today, Fred Monroe. Glad you're joining us. Want to remind you that Central Coast Voices is part of our community connection to you, and you are part of our community connection back. We will do this as a call-in program today, which we prefer to do whenever possible. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. I've had to harp on this a number of times, so I'll harp on it again. Call in early. We have found it interesting that a number of people we've had to turn away because they call in the last 8 or 10 minutes of the program, and we frankly are out of time to wrap up and proceed to the end because we have to end on time. So if you have something about today's topic that you'd like to talk about or you'd like to bring up as a part of the discussion, I encourage you to give us a call early in the program as opposed to late in the program. You're more likely to get heard and be part of the discussion. This is, of course, KCBX Public Radio. You are part of the public, and this is a community that works together. And the program Central Coast Voices is a project of the Action for Healthy Communities program, which is a spinoff of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. And the Action for Healthy Communities does a report about every 3 years, which is a statistical gathering of information. And it's called Vital Signs. The most recent one was completed in December of 2013. You can see and download a full copy of the report at www.actionslo, just run actionslo together, .org. And today's topic is interesting in that we are going to talk about the cost of living in San Luis Obispo County, and this is directly tied to a folio, which is a small snapshot report that is done as part of the action report, and you can download the entire folio online at the same web address, and it's available for free. They're PDFs. Currently online, you can find the report for cost of living, which is our topic today, and you can also find the one that deals with children and the issues of services and benefits and programs for children. That was the earlier folio this year, and we're currently working on a folio dealing with the issue of homelessness in San Luis Obispo County, and that folio should be finished in the next couple of months, and it will be added there also. That site is available to you, and it is kept online all times, so you have a copy of the report. Today, my guests, I have three guests today, and some of them have been involved in the report itself, and some of them have been involved in the community, generally on topics related to both the cost of living and the ability to live and work in San Luis Obispo County. In our earlier discussion, it was interesting. Actually, Bryn Smith, who is the Program Planning and Development Director for basically CAPSLO, a group that I want to call it EOC, but that's formerly EOC, which is now a Community Action Partnership of San Luis Obispo. And Bryn brought up an interesting topic in that all three of the guests in the room today are natives of San Luis Obispo County, which is something I am not. I've lived here since 1979. But they have an interesting perspective because they grew up here and they've now professionally working here in fields addressing the overall standpoint of the community. So Bryn Smith is with us. Kenneth Trigero, who's the Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer with People's Self-Help Housing. And Dr. Ryan Alanese, who is the Associate Professor of Sociology at Cal Poly. And those are our guests. We would like you to be part of the discussion, too. Again, 781-3875. And this is a topic that if you haven't noticed and you haven't thought about what's going on in our community about the cost of living and housing and generally what it takes to live here, I'm wondering how you slept through the last 4 or 5 years. So hopefully you're listening now and not sleeping and we can talk about this. Brandon, let me start with you. The topic that you're familiar with the folio, you're familiar with some programs that CAPSLO does, probably more so than any other organization in the county. CAPSLO deals with a diverse population. everybody, not everybody, a lot of people have been under the perception of the last few months that CAPSLO is primarily focused on only dealing with homeless issues, and that's not the case. So why don't you give us an idea of what programs CAPSLO is involved in and what things related to the cost of living we need to address?
Sure. I work for Community Action Partnership of San Luis Obispo County, and many people seem to know us for our work with the homeless, but sometimes people who are involved with other programs only really recognize us as being the people who do Head Start in the community or health services or the adult day center. So I think really depending on which program you might be aware of, that's kind of what you see us as doing, when really it's a agency that touches on a lot of different areas of helping low to moderate income families increase their self-sufficiency. So we do have programs for families who need child care or early childhood education, health services, energy and weatherization, minor home repair, adult daycare for seniors with Alzheimer's. We're really touching people all across the lifespan throughout this county and also 11 others with our migrant and seasonal Head Start program.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why we invited you to be part of this program today is because there's probably not a segment of the population that you don't have some contact with, and it's difficult to understand for those of us who are functioning effectively in the community, getting by, doing okay, not necessarily living paycheck to paycheck. I think we lose track sometimes of what's going on in the community, and what's being addressed and what isn't. And Ken, let me move to you for a second, because people self-help housing, I think a lot of people perceive it, and for a long time, until I interviewed some people from People Self-Help Housing for the first time last year, we thought that all you were involved in was the building of sweat equity homes, which is not what you do. Well, it's part of what you do, but it's not the only thing you do. People Self-Help Housing, I guess, actually owns some rentals in the county, and actually in the region, because you own some in Santa Barbara County, I guess, also. What are you seeing as the most distressing issue, I guess, for the clients that you come into contact with?
Right. Well, yeah, you're correct. We have about 1,500 rental units in San Luis Obispo County and Santa Barbara County and over in Ventura County. And so we see the incomes that have not grown over the last few years as being very problematic for the tenants that we serve. And primarily we're focused on tenants, residents of the community who are earning about 60% of the area median income and less. So in both counties, the average or median income is about $70,000-$75,000. So the folks that we work with mostly are earning about maybe $45,000 down to about $10,000. And we try to help, you know, those who are at lowest levels as possible. The job growth has just been stagnant in our area, for sure, and so we have a really high demand for our units. So our waiting lists are long. Unfortunately, we can't deliver units quick enough, mm-hmm. obviously, and particularly in the rental side, it takes quite a long time to get projects approved and financed. So They're waiting on us. The people that we want to serve, that's the biggest difficult situation. They're continuing to call and ask if rental units are available that are affordable. And let me just define affordable if I could.
Go ahead.
In our world, we really mean that as we try to make sure, both on the homeownership side in terms of a mortgage when we're doing that, or on the rental side when we're calculating a rent that's affordable. In both cases, we're trying to make sure that people are not going to be paying more than about 30% of their mm-hmm. total income on housing, which includes utilities and things that are associated with water. And so that's what we're really trying to do. So whatever folks are making, we want to make sure that rent or mortgage is hopefully not more than 30% of their income.
What do you do when someone comes to you? Let's hypothetical, if you will. Let's suppose there is something available for them to rent at $1,000 a month, mm-hmm. And they come to you with an income of $2,200 a month, mm-hmm. and they actually believe they can find some way to do it. They might say to you, Yeah, I know it's tight and I know it's not enough money, but doggone it, we need a place to live. We'll figure out a way to make it work.
Right.
You can only figure out a way to make it work for so long.
Right. And kind of the way it works for us is we figure out what we can do in a project before we even build it. So we figure out what's the lowest levels of rents that we could possibly offer in a let's just say in a rental and apartment project. And we figure out, okay, well, we've got X amount if we serve, a portion of people who are earning at 60% of the area median income, and we try to set aside some units maybe at the 50% of area median income and at 40%, and like I say, down as low as possible, usually around 30%. And we calculate what those maximum affordable rents would be at each of those levels. Then we figure out what revenue stream that really is makes available to the property and what expenses that could cover. That usually means we can only raise a very small amount of debt to pay for the development of that property. So the answer becomes how much equity or investment can we get into that property to make sure there's not a debt service associated with that. That's the way we can keep rents affordable over the whole life of the project. So there's a restriction that's going to go on to make sure those are affordable for 55 years. And normally what happens is we're able to go to an investor and say, we need this amount of equity for this project. Would you be interested? The only reason that really they're interested is because primarily we use the low-income housing tax credit program, which is a federal program that enables us to compete for an allocation of tax credits, which really amounts to looks like a piece of paper to us. But for corporations, individuals, banks in a lot of cases who have profits and have a tax burden, they are interested in investing in something like that. In exchange for that piece of paper, they'll put equity into these projects. Yeah. So we figured all that out up front, and then that's how we're able to, once the project's done, go out and let people know we can accept people. If you're making whatever your income levels are, we've got some different possibilities. So of course we've got a lot of interest for that. Most of our projects are around 40 units a piece. So for the folks that show up, we have a lottery system a lot of times because there's so much demand, but we can at least help those people that way.
Yeah. Let me remind you, folks, this is Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe, today, and we're talking about the cost of living in San Luis Obispo County or the Central Coast generally. And you can give us a call at 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. Ryan, there was when I was looking at some of your comments that you shared with me before we put the program together as we were putting all the pieces together, you talked about balancing negative benefits and positive benefits, and that if something becomes more affordable now than it was 6 months ago, that means somebody probably or may have lost money in the deal. I think sometimes we don't pay attention to the fact that there's a balancing act. Somebody's got to pay. Someone's got to receive the pay and do a project or whatever it amounts to. As a sociologist, I mean, we're kind of ganging up on you. We have two people who deal with housing and issues like this, and you deal with looking at more of the overall picture of the society and how it addresses things. What are we not getting right that makes this so difficult to understand?
Well, thank you, Fred. That's quite a big question. I think there's a number of things. As all of us know, San Luis Obispo County is one of the third worst in terms of its homeless population. 90% of our homeless population doesn't have a place to stay. We don't have shelters for them. So somehow, as a community, we've decided that that's okay. I was looking at some of the other statistics around Latinos as well. 22% of Latinos, 22% of our population are Latinos, but they're often invisible. And so a big part of it is making sure we have everybody's voice involved and making sure everybody has a seat at the table. But also asking ourselves, why have we allowed and maintained a type of inequality so that people work very, very hard whether it's in the field or in a hotel room or in a kitchen, and yet still can't afford to live in this place. So there's an amount of inequality that we've accepted, and it's something worth chatting about.
I've seen this in some letters to the editor of the paper, and I've seen this from some other commentary going on, and that is, gee, if you can't afford to live here, why don't you just move someplace else? And it's an absurd question or absurd comment, but we hear it a lot. And I guess I don't know how we bring people to understand that if I want to live here and I think this is beneficial for me to live here, that I don't have to be rich to want to do that, and I don't have to be rich to want to stay. But I think it's a struggle for a lot of people. Gee, I can probably find a rental in an outer area of San Miguel that I can afford to live in regardless of how much money I make if I've got a reasonably full-time job. But then I've got to figure out how to get to work, and I work at a hotel in Pismo Beach or whatever it may be because I can't find any place to live near Pismo Beach where I work. I don't know. That's part of the struggle. But there seems to be an assumption for a lot of people on both ends. The two assumptions are, one, if you don't like it and you can't afford to live here, you know, go live in Wasco. Or, gee, if government would just control and regulate everything, we wouldn't have to worry about it at all. How do we balance that out? And I'm going to ask that question, how do we balance that out, and then back up from the table and hope that I just don't get hit. But I don't know how we balance it out.
I think that's the million-dollar question, because if we knew how to balance that out, maybe this discussion would have happened a long time ago and we wouldn't need to talk about it anymore. But I do think that point that you brought up about people asking, well, if you can't afford it, why don't you leave? I thought about that when I was thinking about this show. I think people forget that there's huge costs associated with leaving, and just because you move doesn't mean that there's job opportunities, or if a housing market... if houses are less expensive, maybe that's because there aren't job opportunities that support the communities there also. So it's not just a simple, like, oh, let's pick up and move somewhere cheaper. People are really invested in their lives here, and they, you know, my family has been here. I've been here my entire life, and I have two children, and I'm married, and for my husband and I to pick up and try to both find professional jobs in other places, we wouldn't be looking at housing markets that are any more affordable. So I think it's a California question. I was looking at the housing affordability index for the nation, and California, well, San Luis Obispo was the eighth least affordable housing area in the nation, and it's seventh in the state, which means that aside from New York City, all the other top eight are all in California. So I think it's not just here, but it's very pervasive everywhere.
I had a thought too, Fred, about that question that I wanted to share, because I've come across the same question, and my answer has been sort of the form in a couple of examples that I've come across as I started working with people self-help housing and developed a couple projects. I remember one time opening a project downtown Santa Barbara, very expensive place to live also. We were able to help two individuals that came to mind. One, a homeless veteran who was born and raised in Santa Barbara and had you know, gone away to war, had come back and was really struggling over the years to on the housing side, and became homeless at one time. So we were able to place him in a unit that was affordable to him, but the answer was, this is home, like you were saying, Bryn. That's, I think, what we need to think about as a community. This is home. We're invested in the community, and the other thing is, we need to have some way for people to stay long term, to build up family units and support systems, so that we don't have a drain of the younger folks moving away and not being able to support the parents. And that was the other example I was going to say. We had another person in that same property who was a senior on a fixed income, very low income earning, was a church organist over in Santa Barbara, or is, I should say. And Her whole family had moved away, but she was born and raised in Santa Barbara. Again, that was home, but they were not able to, they had moved to other states for jobs, not able to take her with them. So she lost that whole support system. Fortunately, there was a way to keep her here and housed, and she was able to stay. So I think those are important things.
Yeah, Ken, as you were making your earlier comments, you were talking about how people self-help housing and organizations like you basically leverage the funding to have housing available. A hypothetical for me, and it may not be a hypothetical, is that if there is housing that people can afford, it really exists. It's just we don't have enough of it. Okay.
Right.
So if I make minimum wage and I live by myself, it's realistic to say, okay, if I can find a studio apartment for $600, I can probably get by. It probably would be better if I could do that and didn't have to drive to work. So I could either have public transportation nearby or I could bicycle to work and didn't need a car. But it's doable. It's not ideal. It's not the way I'd like to live my entire life, but it basically would give me the ability to stay. From what you've described that People Self-Help Housing does, and I've spoken with some folks from the Slow Housing Authority that also owns some rental units, is that there are units like that. What we're talking about is an inventory that doesn't exist currently. Okay. How, is there a way to specifically make more of that class of housing or economic level of housing available? Or are we just running out of places to put it because land cost is too much?
Well, I think, definitely the costs of production is real, makes it prohibitive. So if there's ways that we can address that, the land cost is really difficult because, you know, it's just a market force that takes over there. However, there are things that we can do in the community to reduce costs to produce that housing on both homeownership side and rental side. As I mentioned, these projects take so long to approve, so there's a really long process, usually locally, that has to happen.
And a lot of people think that's just government's fault.
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily the case. I don't know. It's
not necessarily, yeah. Okay. But there's definitely ways of streamlining that. So in as much effort as we can all advocate for streamlining, especially, let's say, on the most affordable units, if that's a community desire and there's a recognition that that's a community asset, then if there can be streamlining and reduced fees, there's quite a few fees that get attached to housing. For example, a recent project that we finished, we paid just in fees alone $45,000 per unit. So you can see you have to raise a lot of money just before you can even get started. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the answer. If there's ways of reducing costs that we can do, that definitely adds to the factor. And the other thing about time is money, as they say. Mm-hmm. And so if we can reduce the amount of time, we can both deliver units quicker, but also reduce costs that are involved in that too.
Yeah. Ryan, as a professor, I guess what comes to my mind, and a sociology professor, to ask you at this point is, what do students say to you when, because I would assume students who are dealing with sociology, which would be your students, are looking at a society around them. I realize when you're in college, you're preoccupied with just getting through college. But a lot of those kids that may have come from anywhere, they may be here on a full scholarship because they're academically very, very proficient, but they don't have any personal resources. Or they may be here because their family worked with them to get to Cal Poly, and the amount of money it cost to rent a place in San Luis is insignificant to them. What kind of observations do you have with your students? What kind of things do you do with students to help them learn to pay attention to those kind of things?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I see it two ways. One, I think that our student body very much reflects our community, in that we're a very privileged and fairly homogenous group of people in comparison to the other CSU San Marcos or Long Beach. We're a very, very wealthy community and wealthy student body. So there's a lot of what I call a privilege of ignorance. And let me give you an example of that that I bring to my students. So I often allow them to have, instead of taking a midterm, to go and do something. It's called a week in the life. And so I encourage them and say, I want you to stand in the shoes of another, to really empathize. And so that could be being homeless for a week. It could be carrying all the water that you use from at least a half a mile away. It can be fasting for a week. But additionally, probably the most impactful is when I bring my students to work in the fields. I grew up in the fields in Napomo. My dad is a farm supervisor. And I have them work alongside immigrant field workers for 2 full days. And when we first arrive, we're looking around the fields, and I point out different plants, and I ask them, what is that? And they have no idea, because we are so removed from our food source, even though we're surrounded by 360 degrees of agriculture here. And so part of breaking down that ignorance is to get them into the shoes of another person and saying, like, wow, I didn't realize this is how hard this type of labor is so hard. 80% of field workers are Latino, and they're the most impoverished demographic of our community. So I think somehow trying to bridge the privilege and let them know, like, you do have privilege, but with that privilege comes responsibility, then they can make better decisions going on in the future.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. This is Central Coast Voices, and we're talking about the cost of living in San Luis Obispo County. Generally, it's part of a folio that Action for Healthy Communities has put together. You can be part of this discussion if you'd like. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. And we would like both your questions or your comments. We appreciate you listening and being part of the discussion if possible. And join us if you'd like. As I mentioned early in the program, Bryn brought to our attention the fact that everybody except me sitting at the table is a native of San Luis Obispo County. So, I truly appreciate you bringing that up, because I want to go someplace with that now. I would invite all three of you. You don't need to take off your professional hats, but I don't need your professional hat answer. You've all lived here for somewhere between 30 and 50 years, and let's leave it at that. but you grew up here. So what have you seen as the difference? Because as people who are now working on issues that affect community and society professionally, you're probably some of our best observers. Jump in, guys.
Well, in my time... Mine's the longest period of time among the group here of having been born and raised in the North County, San Luis Obispo County. So a big difference that I've seen from my early years, if you will, to now is most everybody, in terms of households where there are two parents, both work. That wasn't the case growing up in my era here, and. And that brings a lot of different dynamics. So kids spend their time differently during the day than they did in the past as a result. But that's just a function of I think the incomes that we're earning relative to the cost burdens that we have here on the Central Coast.
So your dad worked outside the house and your home, and your mother did not.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did your dad do?
He was the assistant administrator for the Atascadero State Hospital.
Okay.
In Atascadero. Yeah.
So I don't want this to become the Spanish Inquisition. How long ago did you buy your first house or live out on your own, and what did that cost you relative to what it cost you today?
Right. So in my case, in a little bit more background, my undergraduate degree was here at Cal Poly, but I was really forced to leave the area. By then, the jobs weren't here that enabled me to stay. So like a lot of folks, I think since then, I've had to move out of the area and found employment in the Bay Area, but wanted to bring my family back where my extended family lives here as soon as possible. So we moved back about 12 years ago or so to the area here, and we're able to buy a house here. So that particular period of time was when the recession hit, so it sort of skews things in terms of values. That was kind of at the heated top of the market here. Mm-hmm. Values are relatively at the same level as they were then, just because we had the run-up and run
so
back
you,
down.
So you had the, boy, I should, if I bought a house 3 years later, I'd be better off
yes.
in the financial picture. Yeah,
yes,
hear
for
that
sure.
A lot, yeah.
Right.
When I moved here in 1978 and bought my first home in 79, it was mm-hmm. actually a condo in Grover Beach. Mm-hmm. It was $55,000, mm-hmm. Which strikes me as crazy because I don't know what those are. I don't live there anymore, so I'm not. I haven't really looked to see what those sell for. My hunch is those are probably about $280,000 now.
Sure.
My income has not gone up five times mm-hmm. in that for almost 40-year period,
right.
35-year period. So I think that's probably affected a lot of us. I mean, the housing costs have gone, even after the recession now, I see signs up all over the county, you know, new buildings going on in the low 300s or the mid 300s. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at these, and some of these are twin homes. Some of these are on flag lots where there's four or five units clustered, and they're starting at $325,000. Mm-hmm. So I think it's realistic to say that for no one is the cost of housing the same as what it was for their income, unless you happen to be one of those infamous 1%.
I would certainly agree
yeah.
with that.
Yeah. Anyway, Ryan, what have you seen as the difference? And especially because you mentioned that your family worked in agriculture when you were a kid, you've probably seen a lot of drastic differences. My perception when I lived here was that Napomo was kind of like the affordable housing area. If you couldn't live in San Luis Obispo, or you couldn't, in some cases, if you couldn't even live in Santa Maria, in the mid-70s, the least expensive housing in the area was either in San Miguel or Napomo. So what have you seen over your shorter life than the rest of us in the room?
Yeah, it is it is a fascinating topic. I remember talking to an – I was living in Shell Beach for when I was in college, and I remember talking to a neighbor on the street who had been there 50 years, and he said back in the day, back in the 1940s and 1950s, they actually used to hand out parcels in Shell Beach for free when you bought a new car because that's how worthless it was. So how our values change, you know, you can't get anything probably for under $400,000 now in Shell Beach. We've decided that place is valuable, and therefore it's valuable. It's really, you know, both Napomo, this whole county has grown significantly, Napomo in particular, I think in part due to the climate, but we've seen a lot of gentrification or the wealthier people coming into our county. And it's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just a reality. So we're seeing more golf courses and bigger homes. I just got back from 6 weeks in Peru with a Cal Poly study abroad, and I was visiting my dad down in Napomo, and it was just amazing to go from Peru to these very big, spacious houses. It's just such a contrast internationally, even beyond the county. So we're seeing, and I noticed that in the folio, that we're actually, the middle class is shrinking, at least from 2006 to 2012, yep. where 4% of, it's changed 8%, 4% have gone down to the lower brackets, making less than $45,000 a year, mm-hmm. and 4% have gone to making more than $100,000 a year. So we're seeing a polarization of wealth, and I think that's going to be reflected in the housing market.
Yeah. I don't think we have simple answers. If we had simple answers, people like you would all be fixing it now. Bryn, your turn.
I grew up in Los Osos. My parents still are there. They live in the same house that they brought me home from General Hospital into that house. And it's kind of interesting. Almost my entire life, there's been a building moratorium in Los Osos due to the need for a sewer, which I'm sure nobody has heard
that,
of
before. That actually kind of illustrates how young you are, by the way.
So what's kind of interesting about Los Osos is that the stock of there's not been an increase in housing stock. The houses have maybe improved a little bit, but they haven't been able to add more. They haven't been able to really expand because you can't add bathrooms or anything with adding water. But I think what really strikes me is that now, you know, almost everyone that I grew up with, their families could afford to purchase their own home. And now the housing market has changed. That's not the reality for the people that I know. So there's just a whole lot more people who are forced to have to rent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to add to that. My, you know, going with Facebook and all, you can't keep up with friends from high school and from college. And I'm surprised at how many of my good friends who I used to play soccer with or just go to school with are all over the country because they couldn't find a job that would pay them enough to survive in this county, either with just even with a college education. It's difficult here.
Yeah. I'll give you an example of that fits most for me because it's the member of my family that moved the furthest away, and they may want to be away from their uncle, but that's a different issue. My niece, who was raised in Novato and had a very good job in the Marin County, looked at what it would cost for them to even buy anything at all in Marin County and upper Marin County like Novato and San Rafael, which is not Mill Valley and not Sausalito. And they were absolutely shocked, and they actually packed up and moved to Austin, Texas. And for what they were paying rent for in Marin County, they were able to get into a house with less than 10% down in Austin, Texas. Now, in defense of California, to some extent, I'll tell you the property taxes in Texas are about three or four times what the property taxes are in California. But they basically bought a three-bedroom split-level house in a nice neighborhood in Austin, Texas, for under $160,000. So that's – but they're happy in Texas. They're having a great time there, but they had to do an awful lot to – a lot of research to find a way to get away.
I think
– go ahead.
One of the complicating factors when you have more people now needing to rent or trying to rent, the competition for these rentals also becomes really stiff. So we work with at Community Action Partnership, a lot of lower to moderate income families who are looking for a affordable but also safe and good, like a good place to live, a good place to have their children and their families. And I think that's one of the biggest problems is that when you have this extreme competition for rent, when you have 40 applications, when you put a place up on the market for renting, people are willing to take anything that they can afford. And so the quality of and the upkeep of the rentals maybe isn't necessarily what it could be. So I think that's really impacting not only the cost of living here, but the quality for people who aren't able to afford homes.
Yeah. We had a discussion that involved a representative from the Housing Trust who mentioned something interesting a few months ago, that there are about 2,200 homeless people in San Luis Obispo County. And on the day whatever day that snapshot was taken, they also were able to ascertain or project how many available rental units there were in San Luis Obispo County, and it was about half. So if you were able to find the financial means to get all of the homeless people off the street by helping them rent someplace, we were still unable to find rent. We would be unable to find rentals for them for at least half that population. So I think we're still looking at a supply and demand issue. Mm-hmm. How do we get out of this?
Build more housing. We really need support from the communities when we propose a project, particularly apartments. You know, I think one thing we did learn through this downturn was homeownership is not for everybody, and so we should put plenty of attention on rental housing too. In addition to the affordability, it's just a different option too. But when we propose projects in the community, it really helps to have folks from the community come out and say something to the governing bodies at planning commissions or city councils to say, hey, we really think this is important for our community And we'd like to see you do whatever you can to approve this project, you know, assuming that the folks support what's being proposed. It's common for somebody who opposes a property to come out and say something, of course, but it takes more effort on the community's part to get down to a meeting to support it. And so it's important, though, and I hope that folks would think twice. The other thing that's happening quite a bit now in many of the communities here locally are the cities and counties are updating their housing elements. And that's a part of the general plan that everybody does here locally is required to do, to really plan for the housing that is needed. And that's a great public process. And so if people in the community can come and be a part of those public meetings and give their opinions, it makes a huge difference. And so that's another thing that we can be doing.
I'd like to add to that, too. I think you're right about infrastructure, Ken. We need more houses. But my own research on post-disaster resettlements illustrates the need for social structure to be built along with infrastructure. So we can throw up a bunch of houses, but that doesn't necessarily mean that those people are going to be connected to our community. I'll give you an example. After Hurricane Mitch in 1998 in Honduras, Habitat for Humanity went in and built 285 homes immediately and put in who they thought were the most vulnerable, which were women with children, single mothers with children, into these homes. And then they said, great, you got your home. Good luck. And then within 6 months, a gang came in and took over the community, and every woman had to pay a war tax in order to stay in that community. So it's not as simple as just putting up more homes, but it's also the outreach in the community saying, we want to bring you in. We want you to know who we are. We want you to understand our vision for our community. We want to build trust. And what that'll do is, as the report talks about, eliminate or lower other social problems like crime or gang violence if people are interconnected to the community.
As you were saying that, and I was looking at You shared some information when you shared some observations for us to put together for the program. You shared a quote from Mother Teresa, and if you don't mind, I'll read it. You shared it with me, but it's not your words. If you don't mind, I'll just jump in and say it. Many people talk about the poor, and few people talk to the poor. So I think that's a key thing we're talking about. Of course, we could do. This is going to sound sarcastic, but I don't mean it to sound that way. We could do what they're doing in New York, which is they have to build some apartment houses that include some low-income units. And they've decided that the low-income units in the apartment house will have a different entrance than the higher-income units. And I guess they got approval to do that. I think maybe there's enough of a discussion and an outrage about it that we may see that go away. But I think to some extent we don't pay attention enough to the people in our community. I'm not quite sure where this came from, but I remember reading it some time ago, somebody talking about if you're out on a first date with somebody and you want to see how well this person might be as a long-term partner, the comment was, you know, they may treat you very, very well because they have an investment of impressing you. But what you may want to see is how they treat the waitress or the busboy at the restaurant you go to, someone who's insignificant to them, because we sometimes get the two, we get the assumptions mixed up there. We have people in this county who are saying, you know, let's not cluster too many things together because I don't want too much. I don't want low-income housing near me. Let's put it all in San Miguel. Let's put it all in Napomo because there's no room for it in San Luis Obispo. Look at San Luis Obispo, and this may get me in trouble, but I'll do it anyway. It may be the only community of its size that I know of in at least California, if not the country, that doesn't have a Walmart or a Kmart. And so it does affect how this community may see whether or not they've got space for people who need something that's less than ideal for what they perceive the community to be. How do we educate enough people?
I think community education and outreach is always a big challenge. One of the things that Community Action Partnership does, and I think we do it fairly well. Every other year, we are federally required as our through our status as a community action agency to do a survey, a needs survey of the community. And that one of the things that we do in the planning department is we go out into the field, into Head Start classrooms, into the homeless shelters, and all other kinds of places where low-income people regularly gather for services. And we ask them, what do they need? What are they lacking? What kinds of services they would like to see? What they really need to become self-sufficient? And then we record what they say, and we include that as part of our data report. And then the last few pages are just quotes and quotes and quotes, and what they say is, we need educational opportunity, we need child care, we need affordable housing, we need good paying jobs. And so I think one of the challenges is people, we listen, and then we tell our partners, and it becomes a lot of preaching to the choir. And so we have this report. It is available to anyone who wants to look at. It's called the Community Action Plan. It can be found on our website, which is www.capslo.org. You can find us.
We'll arrange to put a link on the synopsis of this show in the next couple of days, so that'll be available.
It's a pretty long, extensive report, but at the end, you can hear straight from the mouths of the people who are in the low-income community what they need to be successful in San Luis Obispo County. And so I think finding ways to really, I think when you think of like low-income populations and it's the other, and it's that idea of it's someone else and they're just this demographic, but when you really hear the voices and you talk to the people, they're people. And I think that's the biggest hurdle we need to jump with the general population, is that these people are part of our community. They're you, they're me, they're our neighbor. They could be anybody if the circumstances happen so that you lose your job or something catastrophic happens to you. It could be any of us at any time. And so I think really understanding that to strengthen the community, we have to think about everybody and bring them all to the table.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah. Thanks, Fred. Yeah, I agree. Putting a face with the community that you're talking about goes all the way to figure out to bridge that gap. I think that we see that happen when we bring folks that we serve or would like to serve to some of the community meetings. Then people say, "Oh, that's who we're trying to help here." Yeah, let's do that. It bridges that gap really well. The other thing that we hear the comment, like you were saying, sometimes somebody will say, "Well, we don't want that kind of housing in our neighborhood or something," but we've always found in our case over the recent past that since we do really beautiful projects and we always adhere to the standards of the governing body, and we try to make these properties function well, that we really add something good to the neighborhood and a lot of times raise the property values, and then a lot of times have those same naysayers come with us to the next hearing in the next town and say, "You know what, we had this impression of what low-income housing is, but it was wrong because that's not what's happening these days." And now we see, so if you just go and see projects that are already done out in the community, I think that's a way of educating yourself on what product we're talking about here.
As you were talking about that, it occurred to me that the Anderson Hotel that's downtown, I think the Anderson Hotel is about 60 units. They're mostly like studio apartments. It's an older hotel that got converted. It's run by the Housing Authority.
Right.
The front door of that project over on Monterey Street is about 80 feet from the front door of a rather nice restaurant that's over off of the Court Street project. I've been in both facilities. You don't really get a sense that one intrudes on the other. If anything, right, the noisy restaurant probably intrudes more on the people who stay at the Anderson Hotel. And don't get me wrong, it's a very nice restaurant. But I think that we have fears that are not based upon reality. We have fears that are based upon apprehensions that we haven't really addressed.
That's a good way to address that point. I agree.
One of the things we haven't talked about, because it's a recurring theme in some of the notes from all of you, which was we really don't – the report looks at it, but it may not look at it as thoroughly as we need to. We don't look at what really translates into a poverty wage, what translates into a living wage or a self-sufficiency wage. And there's – can we define them for San Luis Obispo County, and does that really put a real dollar on an understanding? I mean, people say, well, they have trouble getting teachers to come work in San Francisco, and these are teachers that get paid upwards of $80,000 to $90,000 a year because it's San Francisco, but they still say they can't get them to come to San Francisco because they can't afford to live anywhere in the city. So what is a poverty wage in San Luis County? What is a living or self-sufficiency wage as we look at a current economy, not the ideal environment?
The poverty wage does not change based on region. So the federal poverty limits are set by the federal government. They're the same whether you're in San Luis Obispo, San Francisco, some little town in the Midwest. No matter where you are, it's based on what your household size is and your income. So if you're four people and that's two parents, two kids, or one parent, three kids, it's going to be the same amount, and that's about $24,000, right around there. A self-sufficiency wage and a living wage changes based on both family composition. So depending on how many adults are in the family, how many children, if there's one adult with two kids, the self-sufficiency or living wage would be different than if it was a family of three with two adults and one child. So the self-sufficiency or living wage really talks about how much money a family or a person needs to make to meet all of their financial obligations based on where they live. And so it's kind of a tricky question because that number is going to be different based on the age of children and mm-hmm. the number. And I think that MIT does a really nice job defining that for every community, and that's a pretty good resource for looking up exactly what they are. But I can give an example if you want.
Go ahead, yeah.
Okay. So a self-sufficiency wage for one adult and two children in San Luis Obispo County is about $57,000. For two adults and two children, it's $64,000.
There aren't a whole lot of jobs that pay that in this county. There's a lot of jobs that do pay that, but yeah. There's not a whole lot of jobs that pay that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the thing that really concerns me and the people that I work with is that it's very difficult to make a living or self-sufficiency wage if you are a single parent. And there are at least about 10% of the population of the households in San Luis Obispo County are single parent households, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. And so we are very concerned about keeping those families stable and able to sustain themselves.
Yeah. The observation I can share with you is that that particular figure of $57,000 is more than the not substantially more, but reasonably more than the starting salary for an entry-level school teacher with a teaching credential for almost every school district in San Luis County.
I'm actually sure it is. As a starting assistant professor, I made $58,000 at Cal Poly. And so it's not so I guess I just barely make it over. But, you know, what's interesting about that point, too, and you bringing it up is in some ways, we kind of want our cake and eat it too. So we want fresh vegetables. We want beautiful streets. We want all of these things, but we're not necessarily willing to pay fair wages or livable wages to people who are doing all these things for us. Because it'd be really expensive
We can look at Seattle in a couple of years because I don't think it's going to be that earth-shattering what they're going to end up with, but that's my personal opinion. Not statistically backed up at all. But they've moved their minimum wage. It's moving up in two steps. It's going up to $10 per hour, I believe, next January, and going up to – I'm not sure if it's going up in a couple increments after that, but within 3 years, it'll be $15 an hour. It'll be interesting to see how that works. I don't think it will be a problem. frankly, I can pay a little bit extra for a hamburger. And I shouldn't eat one anyway, but that's a different issue altogether. But I think that that may be what we're going to see happen. I'm not sure if Seattle is the only city that's done that. San Francisco has done it to a lesser extent, I believe. But that may be what we're seeing. We have to see as a trend, is if people want people to be able to stay in their community, they may have to find ways to raise wages within that community. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Folks, we're almost out of time. I guess we've down just a couple of more minutes. Some closing thoughts? Jump in.
Sure. Well, just as we've all said, it's kind of a two-pronged problem for us here with fairly relatively low wages, incomes. That's a tough nut to crack, but hopefully we can do something on the expense side, the cost burden side. The largest portion, of course, is housing usually for us. And so, again, we're big proponents of doing more affordable housing so that we can get more units placed closer to jobs, reduce folks' gas bills. Of course, that's better for the environment. And speaking of that, on all the new housing, we're able to upgrade the energy efficiencies, and so we're reducing utility bills that way. It's a great way to get at this problem. So that's what we're hoping to do more of.
Yeah. Ryan, jump in.
I think we have a lot to do, but also a lot to learn. And perhaps what I would encourage listeners to do is to meet a homeless person and have a conversation over lunch with them. Or if they're really kind of crazy, just to try and be homeless for a few days. See what it's actually like to go through something like that. And I guarantee somebody's perspective will be very, very much changed by that kind of activity.
Okay. Bren, briefly. I'm running out of time. I'm sorry. I didn't give you more time.
No, that's fine. I think that we really just need to put, like Ryan was saying, put a face to the low-income community and maybe spend some time volunteering and investing our time in our neighbors so that we can realize that that kind of investment is an investment in the entire community and that this issue really does affect everyone.
Yeah. I spent some time in some other circumstances helping with the homeless and doing some things. And I have to tell you, I walk out of that environment, I think, probably feeling a stronger benefit of having been there than even what I've given back to the community. And I think a lot of people who do that and do any kind of work in the community that needs help, they walk out feeling better than they walked in and feeling like, if anything, they got more out of it from just being there than the people who needed the assistance. So I would encourage folks to do that also. I'm going to run through this real quick because we're running out of time, and I wanted to give everybody a chance for some closing comments because this is a topic that's not going to go away quickly. I want to remind you that this is a project for Action for Healthy Communities. We've been talking about the cost of living folio. The entire folio is available at the website, which is www.actionslo.org. And you can give us a call at 543-2323 or by email voices@kcbx.org. And I want to thank my guest today. This has been terrific, and I'm running out of time, and I've got a long narrative for about Chris Kington Barker's program next week. Chris will be with you as your host next week. And even though immunization is considered one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century, there's an increasing number of parents who are not immunizing their children, and San Luis Obispo County, unfortunately, is in the top of the counties in California who with people who are deciding not to immunize their children. And Chris will be with you next week, and she will have Dr. Penny Bornstein, who is the county health officer for San Luis County, and Mike McNerney from Patterson and Tedford Pediatrics, and he's also a commissioner of the First Five Commission. And they're going to chat with you about immunization and how important it is. This has been Central Coast Voices, and I thank you for joining us today.